reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 16, and we are in text 7 and 8. It's in prose, and it's a huge chunk of Sanskrit, so we'll skip the Sanskrit part, we'll be through the translation of Srimad Prabhupada. Okay, translation goes, we'll try to maybe repeat it after that. Translation. Amidst these divisions of Varshas is the Varsha named Ilavrata, which is situated in the middle of the whirl of the lotus. Within Ilavrata Varsha is Sumeru Mountain, which is made of gold. Sumeru Mountain is like the pericarp of the lotus Bhumandala planetary system. This mountain's height is the same as the width of Jambadweep. That's Jambadweep, the width of Jambadweep. Or in other words, 100,000 yojanas, or 800,000 miles. Of that, of 16,000 yojanas, 1,128 miles, are within the earth. It's underground. And therefore, just like trees, you know, as big as a tree is, the root is almost equivalent to underground. So this is 16,000 yojanas down. And therefore, the mountain's height above the earth is 84,000 yojanas, or 672,000 miles. The mountain, which is 32,000 yojanas, or 256,000 miles at its summit, and 16,000 yojanas at its base. Let me move on to the next verse, 8, translation of 8. Just north of Ilavrata Varsha, and going further northwards, one after another, are three mountains. How many mountains?
Three
mountains, named Nila, Sweta, and Singarama. These mark the borders of the three Varshas named Ramayaka, Hiranyamaya, and Kuru, and separate them from one another. The width of these mountains is 2,000 yojanas, or 16,000 miles. And the lengthwise, they extend east to west to the beaches of the ocean of salt water. What is this ocean of salt water? Where is that place? Yeah, you should know that one. That's Bharatvarsha. Bharatvarsha is surrounded by salt water. Okay? Going from south to north, the length of each mountain is 1/10 shorter than of the previous mountain. But the height of them all is the same. Purport by Srila Prabhupada, this is text 8. Purport. In this regard, Madhvacharya quotes the following verse from the Brahmanda Purana. There's a huge chunk of Sanskrit there, so we'll just read through what Prabhupada says after that. He says, it appears from these verses that aside from the sun and the moon, there is an invisible planet. There is a what planet? Invisible. Invisible means? Cannot see it. So listen carefully what happens here. There's an invisible planet called Rahu. The movements of Rahu cause both solar and lunar eclipses. We suggest that the modern expedition attempting to reach the moon are mistakenly going to Rahu. So it's invisible, and how are these people going there? So let's try to work this one out. ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्तस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनोविष्टं स्थापितं येन मुञ्चते स्वयंरूपकरमायं ददाति स्वामिनं. वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरु श्रीमुदापदकमलं श्रीगुरुं वैष्णवांश श्रीरूपं साकजातं सहगणरघुनाथं सर्वैतं सर्वविद्यं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणरूपं श्रीविशाखं पञ्चातपतिभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्येव च पतितनां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णप्रस्थाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिगणनाथ स्वामी नामिने नमस्ते. सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादि वस्तुताये सदाये जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासादि गौर. हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम. So before we start, we'd like to ask the blessings of everyone to try to speak something on the Bhagavatam, especially in this such a difficult chapter and section to understand. Especially we'd like to offer ask blessings from our teachers who has taught us this section, Anupurush Prabhu and Sarvabhauma Prabhu. For their blessings to try to speak something on this. And also Sukadeva Goswami, because he himself will follow the path of the Mahajans. So he himself is saying it's not easy to understand this whole structure, universal structure. And yet, like Maharaj was saying this morning, it's the smallest Brahmanda. So we'd like to ask everyone's blessings before we start. So what are we discussing here? This is one aspect of the Srimad Bhagavat Purana called Sthana or creation. And it's quite a significant part of this canto. It actually covers 11 chapters in this canto. So it's by no means something to be minimized. Yet at the same time it becomes so difficult to understand why is this here? What is this got to do with bhakti? What is this got to do with Srimad Bhagavatam, the personification of Krishna? This dichotomy or this dilemma of trying to understand this whole thing is really intriguing. And we see it's something that even Srila Prabhupada didn't minimize. Because in the Mayapur project that's coming up in Mayapur, what's being built there? The Vedic planetarium. So Prabhupada considered, he wanted people to know what is the Bhagavatam's, the Bhagavat's explanation of the planetary system and the structure of the planetary system. So at least as he's instructed his disciples, especially Sataputta Prabhu and those of the BI, and there's other devotees who also tried to help us understand this. Dhanavir Maharaj also tried to present something on this point. So it's not something very easy to understand. As we can see, it's so on a macro level, it's macroscopic. It's huge aspect of part of where we are and how do we get back to the spiritual world. So at least let us try to trace this route. So what we're hearing about today is this two particular things, because we're doing two verses. One, this Meru mountain, that the different measurements of this mountain, and secondly an interesting paradox there of this Rahu planet and how it's invisible, and at the same time Prabhupada says they could have possibly gone there. So let's try to work on this a little bit. As you can see, the subject matter is so huge, to fit all of this into one class is impossible. So we decided just to take maybe two or three components of this that would be interesting, and you can also try to at least logically understand how can a huge structure like this fit into the human mind. So, like we see here, this is the structure of the universe as is described. But the most important aspect of this is, this is what we want to try to bring to it. That every aspect or every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is trying to help us come closer to Krishna. So although we're not coming to this point right now, but towards the 19th chapter, 1921, this particular verse, this is the goal of this whole chapter. This is what we want to come to. Yesterday, just before the seminar, Janara Maharaj was there, and he was saying, the whole point of everything is bhakti. And I said, yes, Maharaj, you're right. So then the difficulty is how to reconcile this chapter, these sections in bhakti. So he says, well, let's see how we're going to do. So it's true. We were trying to understand the huge nature of things, of this cosmos, and we're also trying to understand that we have to transcend this. Because we get easily enamored here. Easily we get bewildered by the nature of the when things are huge, when something is majestic, we easily get, there's a lot of awe and reverence comes about when something is majestic. So something that's so majestic that we can't even conceive of it is the universe. And that awe and reverence that comes out with that. So by nature, in a conditioned state, we want to enjoy. So when we see something as great as this, to transcend it with spiritual consciousness takes endeavor. Just like there's a joke, one sannyasi, he was collecting money to go to temple. And he realized how difficult this is. So he went to people, grihasthas and different people, and he says, well, if you give some money for the temple construction, then you will be able to go back to Godhead. This is what it says in the Shastra. Oh, yeah, okay, we'll give some money. So people started giving donations very generously. And eventually, it wasn't coming to me enough so that he could actually build the temple. So he was becoming a bit depressed. So in that depressed state, he was praying so fervently. And Krishna appeared to him. He just stood there. Krishna appeared and says, oh, thank you for doing the service, for trying to build my temple. I really appreciate it. But why are you not so happy about this? He says, well, you know, look at how difficult it is. People, they're giving donations and things, but it's not so easy to transcend this world. We want to build the temple, and if we know that if we give donations, we'll go back to Godhead. So Krishna said, okay, you know, as great as this idea sounds, do you want to build a temple for me and everything? But just to show you how difficult this is, why don't you just forsake this order? And if how difficult it is to detach, don't worry about this, just come with me back to Godhead right now. And the sannyasi said, oh, but Krishna, I have to build your temple, I cannot come right now. So the idea of being able to release oneself from material entanglement is not so easy. And especially what we hear in here, a whole mountain of gold, 100 yojanas high, 32 wide, and you know, full of gold, pure gold. Would you like to experience something like this? So it's not something very easy to detach from. So the point comes to this. This is the disclaimer that we want to understand that everything is of every part of this chapter is coming to this point. Can somebody volunteer to read this? You can see it. Anybody can volunteer?
Since the human form of life is a sublime position for spiritual realization.
Yes.
All the demigods in heaven speak in this way.
Yes.
How wonderful it is for these human beings to have been born in the land of Bharatvarsha, they must have executed pious acts of austerity in the past, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself must have been pleased with them. Otherwise, how could they engage in devotional service in so many ways?
Yes.
We demigods can only aspire to achieve human births in Bharatvarsha, to execute devotional service. But these human beings are already engaged there.
Yes, thank you. So this is how the demigods are seeing us. And when we're looking up, we're saying, wow, a huge mountain of gold, I'd like to have it. But how the demigods are seeing, oh, these humans, those who are born in that salt ocean area, Bharatvarsha, this is their fortune because they can do devotional service. So, in understanding this as the goal or as the main point of this chapter, we should understand and read this chapter with this idea in mind. That we are very fortunate to actually be here. Why? Because we have a chance to do devotional service. Something not very... Even Rishabdev, what Rishabdev says is, Nayam deha deha vajam deha kam kastan kaman. If you have this human form of life, you should really appreciate, no matter in the different species that are there, this human form is so rare. And if you have it, this is what you should do. You should engage in devotional service. So we are looking at the demigods and saying, wow, it's so glorious, they're so pious, they're such good qualities. But the qualities that come of the devotee is even better than that. Yasyasi bhakti bhagavata kinchanai. Savai guna tatra sahasta samasyasu. Harava bhaktasya kuto manguna manorate masati pravato vahi. All these qualities come to the devotee. So if we keep this perspective in mind, now let's try to analyze this chapter and see parts of it as this being the goal. Okay? So we were hearing this morning also this similar point. Maharaj was reading out during the mandala just before the announcement time about the brahmanas' wives who didn't do any reformatory kind of activities. They didn't have any kind of big yajnas and samskaras and nothing like that. But the devotional sentiment, by practicing devotional service, they purified their lives so wonderfully. So, the Vedic system, of course, the cosmological system that comes in the Vedas is very unique. Not absolutely unique, because there are other paradigms or forms of knowledge that also give information. But it's derived from this. It's recognized as the oldest astrological information that is available coming from the Vedic scripture. We have books like from the Matsya Purana, we have descriptions of these seven varshas that we were hearing about. Actually, interesting, the Matsya Purana gives it in a different order to what is given in the Bhagavata. But still, the information is there. We have Surya Siddhanta, written by Bhakti Siddhanta Prabhupada. And another interesting text that gives deep information. Actually, it gives more specific information on the measurements of these planets, like the diameter. Diameter, if there's a circle, I had to bring my plate. If there's a circle, this is the diameter across. So the measurements that are giving in Surya Siddhanta actually match modern cosmological measurements, which is quite astounding, considering how ancient these scriptures were written, and they didn't have any of these telescopes and things like that. So what does it prove? It proves that there was a scientific civilization prior to what we conceive as science today. So that's why Prabhupada mentioned so-called science. Because what we see as science or cosmology today is one aspect of it, that which is perceived through inductive reasoning. through the senses. But that knowledge which was coming in the Puranas, in these ancient scriptures, came through ascending process. So it is a deeper, a different form of knowledge, a different process of knowledge, but a much more verifiable, much more acceptable. Because the eyes are limited, like we can see. So descriptions are given, like many of the South Indian astrological books give information of what we study at Jambudu. So they give correspondence to what our modern astronomers see. Like on the moon planet, there's some kind of shape like a rabbit. They mention this. So that is said to be the reflection of Jambudu. Some of the scriptures say Jambudu is the shape of a rabbit. So different descriptions are given like this. So isn't it interesting? Why so big figures? Thousands of yojanas, thousands of huge. Why so big figures are given? So one of the explanations that is there is because the residents in that place are huge. Anybody has an idea what is the size of a demigod? Anybody thought of it? What is the size of a demigod? If you had to see a demigod, what would the size of such a person be? So, just to give you some kind of understanding, if this is a demigod, this little speck here is me. It's described like ant, like an ant. So, just to give you an idea of this, just to give you an idea of this, this is how Lord Shiva is described. And you see him as sitting under the banyan tree, right? On the left there is an equivalent size of Lord Shiva. So this will show you that size again. That is almost an entire continent. That's how huge Lord Shiva is. So if you try to conceive of this, like this is the person who resides in the place. So how big is the place? Astronomically huge. Colossal size. So it's really huge sizes we're talking about here. So what we're seeing is that the observable data that what modern astronomers see, they call it myth because it cannot be verified, right? So what we see, the observable data is not in agreement with observable reality as scientists say it is. Therefore, they don't give it any credence. So when people, Western personalities, studied the Puranas and the scripture that we have information like the Bhagavad Gita, they say, oh, what is this, you know, rivers of juice? Like Jambudwi is described as coming, the name Jambu comes from the fruit Jambu, right? And it's described as the size of an elephant. One fruit is the size of an elephant. It's so huge. And when it falls, it hits the ground and rivers form from that. Now that juice that comes and mixes with the soil of Jambudwi there forms gold. Very, very interesting. It forms gold. Actually, by chemical composition, gold and bell metal are almost identical except for one electron. It's almost identical. So when this juice hits the ground, it forms rivers like this, that are fruit juices. And we'll see just now the four mountains that we heard of. We heard of three here. So the eight is going to be discussed in Jambudwi. So so scientists want us to believe this big bang comes from nothing. So when we say, well, this is what Lord Shiva looks like and this is what how big he is, then they say, oh, that's mythology. But when they propose that everything comes from nothing and it comes out and there's a huge big bang, and we're supposed to believe that. So, actually it's a very interesting way, they just put it in technical language, that everything comes from a big point. It's called mathematical singularity, that from one single point, the whole of creation comes out. And if you take that, and it's just an explosion, then it goes out like that. So if it goes out like that, how are things then come together to be formed? Because if it's going out, it's constantly moving outwards. So how do things come together? How do things, they can only come together by the force of gravity. But we see that it's constantly moving outward. So how then this Big Bang can be accepted as a verifiable theory? They have some proof of it, there are some theories on it. And then they say at the end, it starts with a Big Bang and ends with a Big Crunch. At the end, everything will just crunch down. So even they don't have proper explanations of these things. So what is an important part of astronomy, or to understand this whole chapter, is perception. What does this word perception mean? Perception means the way you see something. And when we say see, we firstly think what we're using with the eyes. So is the eyes actually seeing? What do you think? Do we actually see with the eyes? Because the eyes are just the mechanism, it's the camera. We actually see with the brain. Isn't it? The brain interprets the nerve impulses that come through the eye. So if we see with the brain, that itself is a material thing. It's a blob of jelly. Jello, they call it. So what is actually seen? Because the brain itself is material. So there must be another element to see. Because we see, we understand, that when somebody leaves the body, has an out-body experience, then that person has a different perspective of vision. So seeing not necessarily means with the eye. It means being conscious, having a sense of consciousness. If something is conscious, it has the ability to see, to perceive. Now, if we understand this system of reality in this way, that it may not actually be just from the eyes, then we can actually try to understand this perspective, because this model is coming in different perspectives. There's one level, it's like we were showing yesterday, is the flat surface. Like if I ask you about this object, right? What shape is this? It's round. What shape is it? How can the same object be flat and round at the same time? It's by your perspective. If I'm seeing it at eye level, it's flat. If I'm seeing it this way, it's round. But it's the same object. Just like that, Bhumandala has this kind of description also and understanding. That if you see it from one perspective, it's flat as a mandala. And if you see it from another perspective, it's also round. So different perspectives of actually to understand this in a composite way, in a proper way, there's four different explanations given in the Vedic scripture trying to understand this. So we want to try to get to that. I just want to show you them. So this is Sataputta Prabhu, who has actually made this documentary, and we're just going to see if that's relevant to the verse, how this whole thing is working out.
So this is
Bhumandala, this is what we're describing here. So if you look at it carefully, these are the different varshas, the circles. Now as we're zooming in, watch carefully.
Oceans and islands. These are geographic features. So they're geometrically perfect rings of cosmic size. They're huge.
The satellites to the regular earthly continents.
So nothing on the Earth would resemble. We'd say, well, maybe it's on the Earth, it looks like this. But nothing, no continents on the Earth actually look like this. Now, what we're discussing today is this Mount Meru, which comes up in the center of the middle one, which is Jambardhuma.
In the center of Bhumandala is the circular island of Jambardhuma.
So in the center of Bhumandala, for those of us who are trying to picture what's this whole thing about, in the center is of this Jambardhuma is this Ilavata Varsha, which is a square part, and in the center of that is this Mount Meru.
These include Bharata Varsha, which can be understood in one sense as India, and in another as the total area inhabited by ordinary human beings.
So in one sense it's India, if you see it from one perspective. In another sense, it's the total area inhabited by human beings. That's why it's this, that which surrounds by the salt water ocean is called Bharata Varsha. Now, relevant to today's verse, here comes Mount Meru.
Jambardwipa is centered on the geometrically shaped Sumeru Mountain.
So Mount Meru, geometrically shaped. It's interesting, mountains start broad and then taper. This one is opposite. It starts wide on the top, it's geometrically shaped. Wide on the top, it comes down narrow.
Which represents the world axis, and is surrounded by the city of Bihar.
And on top of it is Brahmaloka.
The Bhagavatam presents astronomy in geographical and mythological language.
So the Bhagavatam explaining what Prabhu is saying in mythological language, which means it could possibly be myth if we cannot verify it. But that's the way it expresses. Now, can it be verified? Let's see.
And the mode of presentation is different from the familiar modern approach. Although the Earth disk of Bhumandala may look naively unrealistic, careful study shows that the Bhagavatam uses it to represent at least four different reasonable and consistent models.
So there's four different ways to understand this whole chapter. So let's see what Prabhu describes as.
These are, one, a polar projection map of the Earth globe.
So the polar, using the pole star, this is called a planisphere projection, or from the planisphere perspective, using the pole star as a guide. That's one.
Two, a map of the solar system.
A map of the solar system, that what has we know solar system.
Three, topographical map of South Central Asia.
Topographical map of South Central Asia, which is in probably in this kind of situation we can understand how Bharatvarsha can be understood as India. That's a third perspective.
Four, a map of the celestial realm of the demigods.
And from the demigod perspective, that means from the higher up there looking down. So we have information, four types of knowledge to describe this. So in our attempts to understand it, we need to have these concepts in mind so that we can have some grip to how this thing is structured and works and makes sense of it. So the question comes up, why do we see through the body perspective? Why are we using the body to perceive? If the eye is just a mechanism to see and the brain is interpreting that, then is vision just limited to the body? Because everything about astronomy is coming from calculation and by seeing, right? That's how that science is designed in the Western tradition. So if we're only using the body to perceive or see, we're limiting ourselves. So there's another realm of vision on a subtle way, in a subtle realm. Now, in physics, the way it's described, it can only perceive reality on one level, from the vision, from seeing. But we see that science has developed, and modern science has come up in the last few hundred years with the idea of quantum mechanics. And this science shows that actually you perceiving or existing, including consciousness, including the person as part of the equation. When you do that, perception becomes very different after that. Because according to this science, there's a famous experiment done on that called the double split experiment. That if somebody is observing, that means if there's a conscious observer, then one result is got. By observing something, one result is got. Like an atom can be seen as a particle and a wave. So by observing, you get one result, and by observing another, you get another result. Yet it's the same thing. So how can an atom, how can one thing behave in one situation as a particle and in another situation as a wave, which are completely two different things? So it can only happen when consciousness intervenes. If we take the same understanding then, if we take the same understanding, that if we seeing a planet, as soon as we are interacting with that planet as a conscious observer, we could be only seeing one dimension of it, as the science is saying. And there could be another dimension which we are not seeing. So if you use that logic, then you can see that what we are perceiving as a planet could not be the complete picture. Because just like these atoms are behaving on one side as molecules, as particles and as waves, just like that if you see a planet, it can also be only the that which is revealed to us, or that is which is perceptible to us. Yet it can be a completely bigger macroscopic view of it. So if we keep that in mind, it is possible that it's not all mythology, because what we see by our eyes is limited to what we can understand with the eye or through the brain. But the bigger picture may be different. And it could be possible, according to the science of quantum mechanics, that it the observer effect, if the conscious, somebody, a conscious observer is observing something. Even, who was it? Einstein said that when I'm looking at the moon, I'd like to believe that it's not just appearing because I'm looking at it. So, many new scientific evidence is coming out showing what the ancient Vedic scriptures were saying. Now I just want to show you something that is really interesting. Yes. So just to verify again what that the ancient scripture of the Vedas and what information it was given is authentic. Now in recent discovery, every planet radiates a certain amount of sound. It vibrates. There's vibration. So the sun planet, NASA has captured that vibration of the sun planet. But we cannot hear it with our ears because we can only hear between 2,000 and 20,000 hertz. Whereas when they converted that sound into what human beings can hear, guess what sound came out? Don't say Mahamantra. As devotees will probably say. But something interesting came up. Watch this.
The sound of the sun was considered by most ancient religions as the most sacred sound of the universe. It is a sound that cannot be heard by the human ear, because the human ear only hears between 20,000 hertz. The sound of the sun is much lower in frequency and also much higher in frequency than we can hear. Could the sound of the sun be part of the universal language system? NASA has recorded the actual sound of the sun.
So NASA is like the dominant authority on astrological features in astronomy of the cosmos, right? So they have done this work and see what they say is the sound of the sun.
Deep space and compress the inaudible waves so that human ears can hear it. If we listen to the sound, we can hear and feel a deep vibration. The sound of the sun recorded by NASA is precisely as the ancient Hindus had described it in the Vedas. thousands of years ago. It is a mantra that can be intoned with human speech as Om.
Experiments, they say, oh wow. So could there be some truth to all of this? Now the other interesting thing, is that the calculations of the planetary structures of our solar system doesn't actually match the Bhagavata, but their orbits, that means the orbit in which they rotated, that orbit perfectly matches the Bhagavatam's description. Now that was actually discovered by Sataputra Prabhu. And that's a phenomenal piece. That's what the previous video was on. He made that video because he discovered this, that the orbits in which they rotate perfectly match the yojanas, or the different measurements given in the Vedic scriptures. So, with that correlation, and with this what you've seen now, is it all mythology then? At least if two or three of these facts, if one could be a coincidence, two could be two coincidences, three could be three coincidences, the more coincidences you have, you can't dispute that it's all mythology. You have to at some point admit, well, it seems to be being verified now with what these astronomers are finding in their own study and field. So we still got to speak something in Jaya Deva Swami. You don't want to miss that. Okay, next 5 minutes, I just want to speak on this measurements of yojanas. This yojana is a very interesting metric measurement. It comes in the Vedic scripture. And how many one yojana is equal to? 8 miles. It's described as 8 miles. And 1 mile is equal to? About 1.6. I have to tell you about this. This is about the sun story, right? So, what is the measurement of the distance between the sun and the earth?
93 million.
About 93 million miles, right? Everybody's heard of the Hanuman Chalisa, right? One verse in the Hanuman Chalisa goes there, Sahasra Yuj Parmanu. Anyone knows the whole verse? Somebody say it? Yes, at the back, somebody? Right, so that verse, right? So let's take the first line. Yuj Sahasra Yojana Parmanu. So one yuj is described in astronomy as 12,000 years. Right? One sahasra is how many? 1,000. And yojana is, we worked out just now? 8 miles. So let's do the easy part first. 8 times 12. 96. So it's 12,000. 8 times 12,000, 96,000. Times 1,000 is 96 million. And our Western calculation is 93 million. So this was written when, and it describes the distance between when Hanuman was going up. It describes the distance between the sun and the earth by just 3 million difference. Now that's why we want to discuss this yojana aspect a little bit, and then we'll do something in Jaya this morning. So the yojana is a very interesting metric measurement because it works at approximately 8. But if it is adjusted a little bit, slightly, then it gives, because there's no actual direct measurement that's given. It's given as approximately 8, but it can also be 7.5. It can also be 8.5. So the orbits in which the planets rotate
When that calculation of the yojana is given as 8.5, then it matches perfectly what the modern astronomers are finding. Like the distance of the orbit of Uranus is 4 billion miles. So that matches perfectly with what the Vedic scripture is saying. And the other planetary systems also, each one of them, as Surya Siddhanta explains. So those match perfectly. So this yojana is a very interesting concept. So how they have measured it actually is by the length of the hand. This is called one hasta, from the elbow to the fingertips. So 32,000 hastas make one yojana. Now, why is there variance? Because my hand length, yours will be different. Right, so there is slight variation there. That's why if you adjust it like that, just like even in Western calculation, kilometers and miles, it's approximately 1.5, approximately 1.4. So that approximation allows for this. And Sataputta Prabhu was saying that when he worked out, when he discovered these orbits that matching to the Vedic calculation, he used the measurement of 8.5. And then the scientist said, well, where is it verified as 8.5? Then he had to do research to show that ancient traditions used this measurement of 8.5. Now, in Cambodia, there is an ancient city that is there. It's called Angkor Wat. Angkor Wat is an ancient city. It's a Vishnu temple. It was a Vishnu temple. And now it was taken over by Buddhists. But that temple that was built is built to the measurement of the yojana when it was measured. And that is perfect. If you see the way it's built and measured, it's perfect to the hasta, and therefore it corroborates with the yojana. So using that method, he verified how, if you take that 8.5 method as those people have used, then you can see how it is actually can be accepted in that way. So let's see if there's something we can do quickly, and then speak something on Jaya Goswami. So these are the four systems that we discussed that was being described. So Mount Meru, as we're discussing today, is the mountain there. And what we were hearing about is the four peaks. We heard of three mountains, five more will be described. So five more will be described. This is the stereographic projection of seeing. Stereographic means taking something from 3D and making it into 2D. So taking a picture, like we know the atlas is a book, but the globe is round. So putting that 3D object into 2D. So that's the method that we use in order to understand the mandal, the bhumandal, and the globe as an aspect. This is bhumandal. So the mandal, the different planetary, the pole star. And then we'll show you that of Lord Shiva. So we have a few minutes left, and maybe we can have some discussion after that. Let's read something on Jaya Goswami. Come back to Vrindavan after going so far. So let's try to read something on Deva Goswami. And his wonderful contribution and to our sampradaya in different ways. We'll just read something brief as he's greatly revered, especially by Lord Chaitanya. Chaitanya will listen to him. So Jaya Goswami was born during the reign of Maharaj Lakshmana Sen of Bengal. In 11th or 12th century, so it was quite a long time back, almost over 1,000 years back, right? 11th or 12th century of the Saka area. His father was Bhojadev and his mother was Bamadevi. For many years he lived in Navadvip. So that's maybe one of the where he got his inspiration, and this was way before Lord Chaitanya's time. And also we see Lord Chaitanya appreciated his works very much. You would miss it. Then the capital city of Bengal, his birthplace was in the Birbhum district, in the village of Kendubilba. In the opinion of some authorities, however, he was born in Orissa. So some say he was born in Orissa, some say he was born in West Bengal, and still others say that he was born in southern India. So nobody actually is not sure, nobody is sure where he was born, but definitely recognized as a great acharya. He passed the last days of his life in Jagannath Puri. So towards the end of his life, he stayed in Puri. And remember, this was way before Mahaprabhu's time. And even his writings was way before Lord Chaitanya had come. One of his famous books is Gita Govind, which is full of transcendental mellow, feelings of separation from Krishna. The gopis felt separation from Krishna before the last dance, as mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, and the Gita Govind expresses such feelings. So it's the most esoteric part of the Bhagavatam that this person has been able to express. So when we're reading and understanding his contribution, we have to filter, be careful that we understand his mood in a proper way and not try to dive into, because this is like the deepest aspect of our teachings, right? There are many commentaries on the Gita Govind by many different Vaishnavas. Then also here, Bhaktisiddhanta, now there's an interesting comment that comes here by Bhaktisiddhanta Srila Prabhupada. So Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur commented in this connection that such feelings of separation as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu enjoyed from these books of Vidyapati, Chandidas and Jayadeva Goswami is especially reserved for persons like Ramananda Roy and Swarup Damodar. So it's quite a prohibition, it means caution. You can see the personalities. He's Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhupada is saying these writings are actually reserved for these kind of personalities. So it's not that we shouldn't read them, but we should read them in association of like-minded devotees where we can have the proper understanding of such deep topics. Swarup Damodar, Paramahamsas, devotees of the topmost perfection, and because of their advanced spiritual consciousness, such topics are to be discussed by ordinary persons, and not to be discussed by ordinary persons, imitating the activities of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. For critical students of mundane poetry and literary men without God consciousness, who are after bodily sense gratification. Why is that? Because these past tense describe the deep connection, the deep past tense of God and Krishna. And if mundane, literally people try to read this and understand this, they're not going to like, we saw, the concept of mythology today. So there is no need to read such a high standard of transcendental literature. Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhupada said, as we said, in association of proper devotees who have understood this in a proper way, then we can. But literally people who are using it as a study text, or trying to deceive the true meaning, then this is not for those kind of people. Persons who are after sense gratification should not try to imitate Raga Yuga devotional service. The songs of Chandidas, Vidyapati and Jayadev describe the transcendental activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Mundane reviewers of these songs simply help people in general become debauchees. Very strong words. And this leads only to social scandals and atheism in the world. One should not misunderstand the pastimes of Radha and Krishna to be activities of mundane young boys and girls. The mundane sexual activities of young boys and girls are most abominable. Therefore, these who are in bodily consciousness and who desire sense gratification are forbidden to indulge in discussions of transcendental pastimes of Sri Radha and Krishna. So he's also written the Das Goswami, the Das Avatar Stotram. When we do puja, we recite them. And in connection to these planetary systems, this is the other point of the goal. Like we said, what is the objective? What are the demigods saying? Devotional service. Human beings have this opportunity to do this. So in connection with that, each of the planets, why are we studying this, is also that each of the planets, as we learn, has an incarnation of Krishna there, as an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of God in each planet. In Hari Varsha, Nashimadeva, Bifnoda Varshas, each one of them. So the point is to remember that Krishna is present in all of these. Otherwise, why is Parikshit Maharaj 3 days to go? Why is he interested in this? He's almost like halfway. Fifth canto is almost halfway to the whole Bhagavatam. He's almost like 3 days or 4 days left to live. So why is he interested in this at this point in his life? So he's trying to seek out where is Krishna. Remember, what does Parikshit mean? To examine. So he's searching out, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? Is it possible that if I'm going to take this path, I'll see Krishna there also? Because to go through up to these planets, we have to go through these higher planets and then go to Bhuva Swaha, through the North Pole, and then go up to Satyaloka and then to the Vaikuntha planets. So he wants to know if in each one of these places, can I remember Krishna there? So that's the point of this whole universal structure cosmology thing. Can we remember Krishna through that? Mana Krishna Padara Vindayo. I want to be able to keep my mind there on Krishna. So Parikshit Maharaj is teaching by example. It's not that it's mundane, but he's trying to show that in every one of these planets, Krishna's expansion is there and how it's there, so that he can remember Krishna through as he's going through understanding this. So Bhagavatam is completely Krishna in its whole, and it's absolute. So as we're studying this, even such a thing as cosmology can help us remember Krishna, as we heard, this universal feature, the universal form. So there's so much more to be discussed. We just discussed like 2 topics here today. This afternoon we have the second part of the discussion also, at 4. So if you're interested, please try to come. We have much more nectar that we can discuss. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Gopremanande ki jai.